This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, exigent circumstances, becoming a PI, and confidential informants. I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau. Welcome to episode number 58 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. And this week, I'm answering your questions about when exigent circumstances allow a detective to circumvent a search warrant, the realities of leaving the police force to become a private investigator, and how detectives procure confidential informants. But before we get into that, as always, I need to thank my patrons on Patreon, especially my Gold Shield patrons, Deborah Dunbar from DeborahDunbar.com, CC Jameson from CCJameson.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of VickyTharp.com, Dharma Kelleher of DharmaKelleher.com, Chris Ann, Jimmy Coe of CrimmyBox, and Larry Darter for their support. I'd also like to thank all of my Coffee Club patrons for their support every single month, and your support keeps the lights on in the Bureau. You can find links to all of the writers supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/58. And to learn about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. This week's first question comes from the Facebook group, which you can find by going to writersdetectivebureau.com/Facebook. And that easy-to-remember link will take you to the private Facebook group called Writers Detective Q&A. So Carol Ann Newsom of canewsom.com writes, "Adam, I'd love to know more about the rules of exigent circumstances. I'm thinking of a scenario in a book I just read where officers are waiting for a warrant outside of an estate where they have good reason to believe, but have no proof, so in my mind that makes a warrant unlikely, that a man is being tortured and killed inside. Should they break in and rescue the man? And what trouble would they face? Could a defense attorney make the case that the victim's testimony and evidence of assault on his body, along with all the serial killer's tools, be deemed fruit of the poisonous tree? And if you cover this on the podcast, I hope you will talk about ways of use and misuse of exigent circumstances can affect a case." I will do just that, Carol Ann. To start with, the Cornell Law Dictionary defines exigent circumstances as circumstances that would cause a reasonable person to believe the entry or other relevant prompt action was necessary to prevent physical harm to the officers or other persons, the destruction of relevant evidence, the escape of a suspect, or some other consequence improperly frustrating legitimate law enforcement efforts. And the exclusionary rule is what Carol Ann is referring to when she mentioned fruit of the poisonous tree. Cornell law says the exclusionary rule prevents the government from using most evidence gathered in violation of the United States Constitution. The decision in Map v. Ohio established that the exclusionary rule applies to evidence gained from an unreasonable search or seizure in violation of the Fourth Amendment. The decision in Miranda v. Arizona established that the exclusionary rule applies to improperly elicited self-incriminatory statements gathered in violation of the Fifth Amendment and to evidence gained in situations where the government violated the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And back to Carol Ann's reference to fruit of the poisonous tree, this means that any would-be evidence that is seized as a result of that unreasonable search cannot be admitted into evidence either. So if you illegally search a home and discover a map with an X marks the spot of where your killer buried a body, right? The exclusionary rule says that that map is not admissible. But then you go and dig up the body of the victim based on the map that you found through that illegal search. That body cannot be used as evidence either because it is fruit of the poisonous tree. Okay, so let's get back to exigent circumstances. There are three scenarios where exigent circumstances apply, which is where police can legally circumvent the immediate need for a search warrant to make entry into an area where someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy, like your house. In your scenario, Carol Ann, we're talking about an immediate threat to life. And to preserve that life, we need immediate access to that area where there is normally a reasonable expectation of privacy. The two other exigency scenarios, which I'm not going to cover today, are just very briefly, they're hot pursuit, like you chase a bad guy into a house, and the other is preventing the destruction of evidence, which has to do with evidence in a crime being destroyed in the amount of time it would take the investigator to get a search warrant and have it approved. And this most likely or most commonly shows up in narcotics investigations. So if you're interested in learning more about these two other types of exigent circumstance types, I will have a link in the show notes to a FLETC page, sorry, a Federal Law Enforcement Training Center page that has a transcript and an MP3 file, sound file, of a discussion about exigent circumstances. And I will provide a link to that FLETC page, the training page on exigent circumstances, in the show notes, which you can find at writersdetective.com/58. So FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, is the basic academy location for a lot of the federal law enforcement agencies. Not all of them, not the FBI and that kind of stuff, or DEA, but a lot of the federal agencies use FLETC as their basic training academy. And as you're listening to the MP3 or you're reading the transcripts, when they refer to an REP area, what they are talking about is a reasonable expectation of privacy area. Okay, so let's get back to Carol Ann's scenario, where the officer believes that the life or safety of a person is in imminent danger, so exigent circumstances exist. The real question here, as Carol Ann writes in her question, is what is the good reason to believe but have no proof? For the life in danger exigency exception to the Fourth Amendment, the officer doesn't technically need probable cause relating to a crime. They just need probable cause to believe someone's life is in danger. If I see flames erupting from a home, I have the same legal exception to the Fourth Amendment to knock down that door and search for anyone inside. I'm not believing that there's any crime. I don't have to believe there's an arson or anything. I just know the house is on fire and someone's going to die. So whether it's a fire or a serial killer that's about to kill the latest victim, if I can articulate why this house or this door needs to be breached and I need to go in to save a life, then I am more than likely going to be covered when it comes to an argument about violating the Fourth Amendment. So yes, they absolutely should break in and rescue the man. And that's assuming they have a reason to be at this specific house and not just using exigent circumstances to break into every home on the block. If you can say why this is the house, then you're good to go. So what if they break down the door and there's no victim? What trouble would they face? Most likely, none, because they were operating under a good faith doctrine. And that's not to say that the city won't be paying for a new door or settling some sort of lawsuit regarding invasion of privacy or something, but the officers were in good faith trying to save someone's life. So it's not like they're going to be facing burglary charges or anything like that. Now, what if they break down the door and there is a victim and even hopefully a suspect? Hopefully the victim's alive, but either way, once the threat to life has been made moot, whether that's because the victim is now alive and safe and we're protecting him, or because the victim is dead and there is no longer a threat to that person's life because it's already passed, we should now consider that scene frozen. Now, at this point, hopefully the suspect is now detained in handcuffs and taken out of the location. From this point, the officers are allowed to do a protective sweep of the location, meaning checking for other suspects in other rooms, closets, crawl spaces, etc., to make sure that there are no other threats inside the location. But other than that protective sweep, that scene is frozen. There's no searching, there's no going in and out or any of that kind of stuff until the police get a search warrant for that location, because that exigency is over. It is permissible for the detective writing the search warrant that's now happened after the fact to include any observations made by the officers that made the exigent circumstances entry They can include that statement into the statement of probable cause supporting the warrant. So if I was the uniformed officer that kicked down the door and saw the suspect and victim in the room, I can give a statement to the detective to that effect. And that detective can include that as part of his probable cause for the search warrant. Now, any decent defense attorney will file a motion to suppress any evidence that stems from the unwarranted entry to the location. Whether they're successful depends on the circumstances and their argument. But there's no downside for the defense to filing that motion, so I guarantee they're going to do it. The worst case scenario for them is that all the evidence remains in evidence. But their best case scenario, from a defense attorney standpoint, is that key pieces of evidence against their client are going to be tossed, just as Carol Ann said, as fruits of the poisonous tree. So the next question many of you might be asking yourself is, how could that evidence, let's say the knife and the duct tape seized from the scene, be suppressed from being introduced at trial? It really has to do with the cops overstepping the limitations of the exigency. Once the threat to life is over, so is the exception to the search warrant. So if the cops don't consider the location frozen after they render the scene safe, like they keep searching the house while the detectives are off writing the search warrant, all that evidence is likely going to be thrown out of court. And that's because of the exclusionary rule for evidence. And the same would apply if the police fabricated the exigency, like they were claiming there was an emergency when there wasn't. That too could be used in a motion to suppress. Now that said, the testimony of a surviving victim of a serial killer would still very likely be allowed as evidence, regardless of whether a Fourth Amendment search and seizure issue arises from the search for physical evidence. My take on it, it's not legal advice by any means, but I would imagine that it would still be allowed as testimony because the victim's account of what happened started long before the police were involved in kicking down the door. So thanks for the question, Carol Ann. You can find Carol Ann at canewsom.com. Elizabeth Clark writes, "One of my recurring characters is a uniformed police officer who is about to make detective. In my first book, we meet her as the victim of a shooting during a traffic stop, from which she almost died. My question is this, would it be credible for the character to shift from being a police officer to taking a job at a private detective agency as a result of the shooting?" Absolutely, Elizabeth, I think it would be credible, especially given the psychological impact on your character of having this near-death experience. It is not uncommon for victims of shootings to do a lot of soul-searching and asking themselves the question of whether this is the right career for them anymore. So in that respect, I can totally see your character going from police officer to private investigator. The important thing to know, though, is that in the United States, you have to pass a state examination to become a licensed private investigator. It's no different than becoming a barber, an esthetician, or a security guard, but you do have to go through that testing process. So your character would need to study, take an exam, and wait for the pass-fail results back from the state before working as a PI. And in some states like California, they require a certain number of work experience hours to become certified. Now, it doesn't mean that they can't work for a private investigation or private detective agency in some other regard in a support role until their PI license is finalized. So you can certainly research that. I'm actually going to include in the show notes at writersdetective.com/58, a link to a page that lists the requirements for all 50 U.S. states for becoming a licensed private investigator. So since your character was a police officer, it wouldn't be too terribly difficult for her to transition to working as a PI. It may just take a few months to get through all of the red tape. L.K. Hill of authorlkhill.com writes, "I'm wondering about how CIs are acquired by detectives. Any general info you can give would be great. Do detectives approach prospective CIs or the other way around? Is there any particular process for them to connect for the sharing of information in terms of not blowing the CI's cover? If a CI is picked up for a crime, do they enjoy any protection or passes from law enforcement because of their CI status? Also, who would know about them? Just the detective, his fellow detectives, the detective's superiors? Are there files kept on CIs? And what's the process if a current CI no longer wishes to be one? Thank you for all you do and keep up the good work. Thank you, LK. Those are great questions. There are three primary types of informants in the criminal justice system. The first one is the confidential informant or criminal informant, as you're referring to. There are anonymous tipsters, and then there are citizen informants. Confidential informants overwhelmingly become informants as a result of being captured for a crime. So the informant is working in his own best interests, which is usually to have either their charges dismissed or at least have the penalty reduced. And we do refer to them as CIs for confidential informant. And the way this typically works is something like this. Let's call them person A is arrested for possessing cocaine, but person A doesn't want to go to jail and lose his job. So he agrees to become an informant. Person A signs an informant agreement to work with the police narcotics unit in exchange for that possession of cocaine charge to go away. Now, that informant agreement is actually a binding legal contract, and it lists the expectations of both parties. What is expected of the informant, meaning what he has to do to get the charges dropped, and then what's expected of the police department and the prosecution. Since the prosecutor is the one deciding who does and does not get charged, they are actually a party to this informant agreement as well. Usually the prosecutor and the narcotics unit have a set protocol in place for when a prosecutor, which would be a deputy district attorney for where I work, but it could be a state's attorney or some other prosecutor title elsewhere. But there's usually a set protocol for when a deputy DA has to be present for the contract negotiation versus when it's just person A and the narc. So if person A was caught with a few grams of cocaine, the agreement between the DA's office and the narcotics unit is already set, so the DA doesn't have to be there for it. The DA's office, just as a matter of policy, is willing to not file charges provided that person A meets all of the expectations in the contract because, you know, they deal with a couple grams of cocaine for informants all the time. That's not anything big. But if person A was caught with, let's say, kilos of cocaine, the DA would definitely be present and likely draft a specific informant agreement for this informant rather than a boilerplate one, because they're not going to simply drop all the charges against the multi-kilo cocaine trafficker. So person A is likely looking at some sort of leniency for punishment rather than charges being dropped in a bigger case. So what makes an informant confidential? In many states, we are able to withhold disclosing the identity of an informant for a pretty significant amount of time. When I'm writing a search warrant based off of something my informant witnessed, I'm not using person A's real name. I'll refer to him by his file number, and I will use gender-neutral pronouns to help protect the identity of the informant. To my knowledge, though, federal court cases always disclose the identities of informants, and most feds I know refer to their informants as sources rather than CIs. Now, there's also a difference between a CI and a CRI. The R stands for reliable. This means that the informant has demonstrated that their information is reliable. These are some of the most unreliable people in society, so keep in mind that reliable means the info they turn over is reliable, not that the person is reliable. So how would I, as a narc, make person A, my new CI, my confidential informant, a confidential reliable informant? I would have him go buy drugs from his drug dealers and bring them back to me. Now, that sounds very simplistic. In reality, this means I'm searching him to make sure he doesn't have any drugs on him. I'm controlling every move he makes leading up to, during, and after the drug buy, and then he's turning the drugs directly over to me after he buys them, and I search him again. So this is a very specific kind of operation that's very surveillance intensive. But once he's done this a few times, I can attest that he is a reliable informant, because his claims that he could buy drugs from drug dealer A, B, and C proved truthful, and I have the drug evidence to prove it. So those purchases would be used as the probable cause for my search warrants for dealer A, B, or C's locations. Now, I'm obviously oversimplifying this to protect a lot of our tradecraft, so I hope you get the picture. So as for the CI or CRI's immunity, the only immunity he technically receives is immunity from the crime of possessing that drug while he's working for me, while we are doing that specific operation. He does not get blanket immunity. So if he goes and scores a dime bag an hour after he's done working as my informant and he gets popped again for possessing that dope, he is not immune from prosecution. Not only that, part of his informant agreement is that he is not to disclose that he is an informant to anyone. So if he gets arrested again and he says, "I'm a CI for Detective Richardson," to that arresting officer, he just breached his informant agreement. And this happens all the time. Of course it does, because they're trying to get out of trouble. So not only would he face new charges, he would likely still face the original charges that he had when we signed that informant agreement. Because he broke the informant agreement with me by disclosing that he's an informant. Informants are worthless if people know they're working for the cops, and often it is enough to get them killed. So we take that stuff very seriously. And to answer your other question, LK, only the handler and the immediate members of that investigative team, meaning the immediate supervisor and then any of the detectives that might be working the surveillance that involves the informant, are going to know the identity of that CI and even that that CI exists as an informant. We do take operational security for informants very seriously because they are trusting us with their lives. For this reason, in fact, at least where I work, our informant files are still hard copy only. It's the only surefire way that I know of to keep those records hacker proof. So we have a photocopied piece of paper where we literally write in the person's name and all of that kind of stuff and put their informant agreement in there. That's all hand filled out. None of that gets entered into a computer database anywhere. Now, once the CI has, as we say, worked off his beef, once he's done what he needs to do to get out from under that possession charge, he's done. So for person A, who is now CRI A, let's say, he's done three drug buys that led to three successful prosecutions. He's met the conditions of his informant agreement by doing that. And those cocaine possession charges are never filed. He's free to go on with his life like it never even happened. If he decides he doesn't want to work as an informant before he meets the requirements of his informant agreement, let's say he's required to do three drug buys and he only does two, then he's in breach of that informant agreement, that contract, and now he's going to face those original charges. Now, there are some people who are really good at being CRIs and even like doing it. So if person A, if CRI A met his informant agreement obligations and he wants to keep working, the narcotics unit may actually pay him. We refer to these CRIs as mercenaries. They'll contact their handler whenever they have actionable information that they think will get them paid. The value of that information is obviously going to depend on a few things, and how much the mercenary gets paid is also going to depend on how much work they do for the police. So I hope this helps, LK. Thank you very much for the question. And you can find LK's work at authorlkhill.com. Now, before we go, I have a question for you. How many passwords do you have? And how often do you reuse your passwords? You know, changing them by one character or using the same one over and over again? It's kind of like flossing. We don't really think about it. And when we do, we know we should do better. And then one day it all catches up to us. Managing your passwords, and I mean secure passwords, shouldn't be like pulling teeth. I've been using LastPass as my password manager for years. It was actually the third password manager I tried, and it was by far the easiest to use and the most robust. It generates strong passwords for me, securely stores all of my passwords, my credit card info, and even notes I make to myself. This way, you only need to remember one password, and that's the one to get into LastPass. Getting started with LastPass is totally free, and upgrading to LastPass Premium, like I did, is just $3 a month, which allows you to sync your entire LastPass vault across all of your devices. I have it on my phone, tablet, laptop, desktop, and I can even access it through the website when I'm away from my devices. It's super fast and easy to log in to any website that you have a username and password saved for. If you're interested in checking out LastPass for free, or you can help keep the lights on in the bureau by upgrading to LastPass Premium for $3 a month, you can use my affiliate link by going to writersdetectivebureau.com/LastPass. I only promote products I actually use and trust, and my affiliate links never add any additional cost to you. LastPass is the only password manager I use, and I've been using it for years, at least a dozen times a day. So go to writersdetectivebureau.com/LastPass to get your password situation totally squared away. Thank you so much for listening this week. Keep those questions coming. You can send me your crime fiction questions by going to writersdetective.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening. Have a great week and write well.